The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
In recent weeks, in this particular group, in this particular class, we've been exploring things that we add, or things that are added, perhaps I should say, in some ways, because sometimes this adding process to experience, things that are added to our experience, is less of a conscious doing and more of a subconscious or conditioned process of, just again, being human. It's very natural, in a way, for us to respond to unpleasant experience with some pushing away, some not liking, some wanting things to be different. And yet this adding, this phenomenon of adding to our experience or of noticing what's additional above and beyond what's actually going on in our human experience. It's a big place, this adding is a big place where suffering happens. And so in recent weeks, I've talked about adding reactivity is one way that that this adding happens. That when we meet experience that's pleasant or unpleasant, there's a way that very naturally, in a very, as I said, in a very human way, when things are pleasant, we like it, we want it to continue, we want to hold on to it. When things are unpleasant, we want to get rid of it, push it away, fix it, change it. And so this phenomenon of things as they are in our human experience is that there are pleasant experiences and unpleasant experiences. And the part that's added, I'll say, maybe what we can talk about the added part is stuff that goes on in our own minds in relationship to what's actually happening. And so while it's very natural for us to like and want to hold on to something that's pleasant, that liking and wanting is a mental phenomenon. So it's not inherent in what's actually happening. And so this, what's going on in our minds around what is actually happening is what we're interested in exploring here in terms of what we're adding. And so this adding of liking, not liking, wanting to hold on to, wanting to get rid of, desire, aversion, that's a big place where we struggle, where we suffer, because in the wanting to get rid of and wanting to hold on to, there's a tension in our experience. It's a rejection of things in this moment. And so there's a tightening in this moment it's not okay that this pleasant experience may vanish. It's not okay that this unpleasant experience is here. And so there's this resistance and this reactivity, and in that moment the not okayness of that is a form of suffering. And I always have to say this, it's not that I'm trying to say that we just simply sit there and grit our teeth around unpleasant experience and, you know, try to bear through it. You know, a classic example is pain in the body. You know, if there's pain in the body, it's useful to understand our reactivity to that pain in the body. You know, we have a pain in the knee, for example, and to recognize that we don't like it, we are averse to it, and to begin to see actually that reactivity, that aversion, is creating extra tension in the mind and body and often exacerbating the pain. So it's really useful to recognize that relationship between pain and reactivity. And yet, pain in the body is often a signal that something needs to change, you know, certain things, like I have sciatica, for example, and so there's certain pains in my body that I know mean this nerve is being pressed on, and this nerve will get damaged if I'm not cognizant of that and move. And so there can be a relationship to that that's not one of aversion, but one of wisdom. Not of hating that pain, but actually recognizing and appreciating, the body's sending a signal. Okay, I need to move for this one. And it is very useful to begin to recognize that reactivity, because so much of our relationship, in this example to pain, is around this reactivity that's really creating extra suffering. So that's one piece that we add often. I talked about that a few weeks ago. And then I talked a few weeks ago, about views that are we add ideas and views and beliefs to what's happening. And again, this too can be an area where we suffer. We have certain beliefs about what should be happening in the world. One very central belief, you know, that comes right along with pleasant and unpleasant experience and our movement to hold on to the pleasant and get rid of the unpleasant. You know, in the very movement to hold on to the pleasant and get rid of the unpleasant is the view or the belief that doing that is what will lead to happiness. Doing that is what will bring ease in my life. And there is a way, I mean, there's definitely a way in which acting on greed and aversion creates the conditions in the very short term for us to experience some measure of ease. We get something we like. Ha, the body relaxes. Ha, I figured it out. I know how to get things. We get rid of something we don't like. Ha, figured it out. Now I know that I'm okay right now. And so this belief, this view that the perspective of having things, getting rid of things, is the way to happiness becomes kind of more entrenched in a way, because we get feedback in a very short time frame that this is helpful. That we have a moment of ease or peace or release when we get something that we want or get rid of something that we don't want. But what we don't understand in the larger perspective is that view is ultimately confused, because the getting what we want and getting rid of what we don't want just conditions that movement of mind that is that tight, has to be the way I want it to be. And so we kind of set ourselves up to be in this place where, there's something, I got what I liked, I got rid of what I didn't like, and that changed. Because the world changes, experience changes, and having what we like and getting rid of what we don't like is only a very momentary phenomenon, it's an impermanent phenomenon. And so we're put back in the situation of finding ourselves in presence of things we like and don't like and having to do it all over again. And so this view, having what I like, getting rid of what I don't like, is a huge one that kind of is underneath this whole movement to wanting and aversion. Many, many more views that create suffering in our experience. And one, needing to have people think certain things of me, for instance. Believing that in order to be happy, I need to have people have a certain view of who I am. And doing a lot in our lives to convince people we are who we want them to think we are. So again, views, that view of wanting people to think we're a certain way, a certain kind of person. Again, we're kind of in this continual machinations of proving ourselves. And the other piece of that is that we're at the mercy of other people's views and opinions. We see in our own minds just how fleeting and ephemeral and changeable our own minds are. And so trying to base our happiness in what other people think, again, a deep form of suffering. So again, you know, many, many different ways. I talked about this a few weeks ago. And today I wanted to explore a kind of another level, a subtler level of ways that we add to experience. And this is about, it's the creation of concepts and how that happens. And concepts are a pretty foundational part of our experience. You know, we have concepts about everything. And they're based in perception. Concepts are based in perception. So perception is, you know, that we meet our experience. All of our senses have particular forms of perception. So through our eyes, we see things. They're sights. And actually, it's very hard to see this. but actually, what our eyes see is just color and form. That's all that our eyes see. We look out in the room, and we think we see walls and chairs and people and carpet, windows. We think we see that. But that's a process in the mind that is creating the understanding of that form and color. It's basically taking that form and color and laying the pattern over it from repeated contact with these patterns. This is what we see. Hearing, similarly, we experience pitch and tone, and yet we hear a car go by, and we think we hear a car. But what we're hearing is sound rising and passing, a particular configuration of pitch and tone that our mind recognizes as car. And so there's the perception level of experience. And in a way, I think the perceptions are layered. And so I look out here and see chairs and carpet and microphone and people. So the first layer of perception is just the form and color. And at this point, that's not available to my consciousness, just seeing this experience as form and color. I don't see this just as form and color. I see it as objects. And so, you know, the first level of perception is form and color. And then, again, through repeated exposure to particular configurations of form and color, our mind understands this is a bell. You know, it's not hard for us to understand this is a bell. And thank goodness, you know, it's like, perception is really the mind's way, or maybe we could say the brain's way, of reducing the energy needed to figure things out. So, you know, if we had to walk in here every day and figure out, you know, if our eyes were like the new eyes of a child and figure out what everything was, it would be exhausting. You know, I think this is why babies sleep so much, you know. They're figuring things out, you know. So we have, our brains and our minds have this capacity to begin to recognize these patterns. This is great. It's a really useful part of our minds. So this is a function of our minds, this perception. It's based on memory. Perception that I look out here and it's like, that's a chair. I know that's a chair. You know, it's like this eye and this mind have seen that configuration enough to know that it's a chair. So this perceptual process, it's like over and over again. I was a computer programmer, so I'll use this language. My apologies if this does not resonate for you. It's kind of like pattern matching. You know, we see something and our brains go, what has been like that before? So this pattern matching is like, oh, it's kind of like that thing. Oh, and I've heard that's called such and such. And so It's like this movement to create names, to create labels for experience. So the function of perception is to recognize our experience. The way this happens, and it's possible to start to see this in, you know, just to begin to recognize that this perception that's happening of what we're experiencing is in the mind. It's not the actual contact or contact with our senses. It's not a physical thing, this perception. It's a mental thing. For me, the easiest way to recognize this is in the terrain of hearing. So you might notice this. It can be subtle, but just drop it in there. You don't have to look for this, but you know, maybe in some meditation time you've noticed, for instance, you're sitting here quietly in this room, and a loud sound goes by. It's got a rising to a pitch, and then it diminishes with a high volume. And so that sound is what the ear hears. But very quickly, your mind might give it a name or give it an image. Your mind might have the word motorcycle pop into it, or it might have the image of somebody riding a motorcycle pop into it. That's perception. It's a rudimentary form of thought that is recognizing, ah, that sound, that's like other sounds I've heard. I've recognized that as a motorcycle. So this is a process that happens kind of automatically in our minds. It's not something we can stop. You notice that's a bell, the sound. Hard to not notice that. It's just the mind doing its thing. It's not an option we have. All right, now, try to not hear the bell. We can't do it. So this process of perception is a function of our minds, and we're not trying to stop it. And yet, what happens, and where we add, and where we end up struggling and suffering around it, partly because it's a process of the mind, it's really prone to making mistakes. The perception itself is prone to making mistakes. It's prone to influence by opinions and views and ideas. It's prone to associations that come along with particular perceptions that we don't distinguish from the perception itself. So we easily get caught by this process of perception. It's a place where our minds are a little confused or misunderstanding, perhaps I should say, misunderstanding what's actually going on. In the Buddhist texts, he gives an analogy, the Buddha gives an analogy for perception. He says it's like a mirage. The Buddha's analogies are often quite appropriate. He seemed to be a master at analogies. And so, you know, in our language of mirage, you know, we often think it means seeing something that's not there. And so perhaps this use of mirage might be confusing to us, that, well, we're seeing something that's not there. You know, so my perception of motorcycle, it's not really there. And so that's not actually the meaning of this analogy. You know, what a mirage actually is, the technical definition of mirage, and I'm pretty sure the Buddha was aware of this, is that, you know, particularly you can see this if you're looking out at the horizon on the ocean. There are images, there are photographs of these mirages, of, you know, if there's a particular amount of moisture in the air and the place that the sun is coming from, all the conditions are just right, you may see an image of a ship floating in the air that is actually a ship that's under the surface of the horizon, that's beyond the curve of the earth. So it's like a mirror. The ship is reflected in the air, and we can see it. So this is what a mirage is. It's a reflection of something that is there. It's not the actual thing, but it's a reflection of something that's there. So it's kind of, you know, like a mirror in that way. You know, it's an image that appears to be there. The other classic image, a classic mirage, is seeing water in the desert. And this, I understand, I actually checked this out on the internet to see, you know, what is that about, seeing water in the desert? And it is the reflection of the sky on the ground. Again, not on the ground, but in the air, in the heat waves coming off the ground. The sky is reflected, and so the land appears blue.
The sand becomes a mirror.
Well, it's not the sand. It's actually, I think, it's in the air waves, and so it's reflecting. So you're seeing the blue of the sky, and so again, it's a reflection of something that's there. It's not completely made up. So this analogy of perception being like a mirage to me is important. It's not that we're completely making things up out of, you know, whole cloth. What we are perceiving is a reflection of what's out there. So it's a representation of reality. Our confusion, or part of the way we add to this, the way that adding happens, not that we are doing this, because this is very deeply ingrained in our system. It's not hardwired. It's not something that, you know, there's no way to see through, but there's a tendency in our minds to take this perception not to be a representation of reality, but to be reality. And so this is a kind of a form of adding, that whatever is perceived, and I'll use the word concept for this, we perceive something, and then the concept turns that perception into a thing, kind of makes it a reality in our minds. Now, again, this is useful in a way. It kind of stabilizes our experience. And I think that the part of this function of, we could call it reification, objectification, creating a concept from perception. You know, when we actually look at something, you know, if the like using sight here, the actual experience coming in is changing so much. I mean, you're all sitting fairly still, so it's not changing that much for me here now. But if somebody were walking through the room, the changing nature of what's being seen moment to moment is so much information for the mind, that the mind, again, uses that concept to stabilize and make it less energy to keep recognizing, that's that person. So again, these concepts are useful, but what we what we don't see or don't recognize is just how much, when there's something going on in our minds and we don't see it as a process going on in our minds, it's very easily influenced by associations, opinions, agendas, views. So an example of this. Suppose you're having a conversation with somebody and you say something and the other person raises their eyebrows. That's a perception, the sight of seeing somebody raise their eyebrows. Perhaps in your family, a raised eyebrow meant dismissiveness, meant somebody, you know, that you learned that raised eyebrow meant that somebody thought, nah, don't believe that, or whatever, you know. So there's an association of that. And so in this moment, standing here, talking to the person, seeing the raised eyebrows, you feel dismissed. So that what has actually happened is that there is the perception and the concept all pretty much under the radar. You know, this is not happening in our conscious thoughts. But we see this, and because of the associations from our past with raised eyebrows, we feel an emotional reaction. So perceptions and concepts. So the perception, it just happens. Concepts are the mind kind of reifying or creating something solid, taking the perception to be real. And then along with concepts come so many interpretations. So the danger around perception and concepts isn't the processes themselves, but that they're not seen as a process of mind, and not seen for all of the ways that beliefs and views, that way that I talked about the other day, the beliefs and views come in to infiltrate. This is a way in which beliefs and views kind of get associated with concepts and are basically not seen as beliefs and views. They're seen as reality. So there's a teaching story in the suttas around this. Anybody not familiar with the teaching of the blind people and the elephant? Okay, I'll give a brief story of the blind people and the elephant. So this is a story about a king who wanted to point out the way people, you know, the way people do things and be a little amused. He sounds like he was a little bit of a, not a very nice king in a way. So he asked his elephant trainer to gather, or ask one of his ministers to gather all the blind people in the kingdom, and his elephant trainer to bring an elephant. And he said, okay, show the blind people an elephant. And each one got a contact with a particular part of the elephant. So some got to touch the legs, some got to touch the tail, some got to touch the tuft of the tail, some got to touch the ears, some got to touch the side of the elephant. And then they were asked, so tell me what an elephant is like. And each one had an analogy. Again, this is the way perception goes back to memory, right? So the people who had touched the leg said, well, an elephant is like a post. The people who had touched the tuft of the tail said, an elephant is like a broom. People who touched the side of the elephant said, it's like a wall. So, you know, each person had an association or a perception that was different based on which part of the elephant they had touched. This is not surprising. This is, each one had this experience, this direct experience. The teaching story goes on then to say, so, when each person heard what the others thought the elephant was like, they began arguing. No, an elephant is not like a broom. An elephant's like a post. An elephant's not like a post, it's like a wall. And it's, the story says they came to blows over this. So this is an example of the kind of trap that we can get into around perceptions. In this case, you know, in this case, each person's perception was not wrong. Many of us would have said similar things about that perception. What was not understood was that it was only a piece of the story. It was a perception of a small part of what an elephant was. And yet people trust their own experience. This is what I experienced an elephant to be like. So this is right. Nothing else is right. So this reification, again, so this is the concept. This is the concept making that... there's the perception, and then the mind makes that the elephant. And then can't hold another perspective. We do this all the time. It's actually amazing how much we do this. And block out other possibilities of what might be happening. In part, some of these perceptions, identifications, you know, perceptions of concepts, part of the extra piece that's added has to do with identifying that my perceptions are right. My perceptions are true, are accurate, are correct. And so in this case, you know, it's interesting that, again, the story is pretty, it's got a lot of layers to it. In this case, the story of the people who were conflicting, it's like rather than, that's interesting, my experience was this, your experience was that. Let's see if we can figure this out. Let's get to the bottom of this. It was, no, my perception was right. This is what an elephant is. And so some of that conflict came around the identification. And so this is another area to be curious about. Are we identified with our perceptions and our concepts? I had an example. You know, so perception impacts our experience. We see things, we create a concept around them, and again, because of associations, we have experience. Those experiences are based on a reflection rather than the actuality. And much of the time, our perceptions and our concepts are relatively in line with what's happening in the world. And so we don't really notice that this is a representation rather than reality. In fact, in some ways, the idea that, you know, we navigate the world so well in so many ways that it gets kind of reinforced that our concepts are reality. I mean, if I were to walk through this room without, with like ignoring the fact that chairs were there, I would be falling over everything. So it's really useful to have this sense that that chair represents something in reality, and to walk around it. And yet, so you know, the whole process by which perception and concepts work serve us really well, and much of the time, it's relatively, close to what's going on in reality. Perception and concepts can make mistakes, however. And when we see this, we can really get a sense of just how much is going on in our minds around perception and concepts. So an example of this from my own practice, many of you have heard this story before. I was in Burma and meditating a lot in my room. And my room was in a building that was pretty close to the wall of the monastery. So the wall was, you know, maybe 30, 40 feet from the my room. And, you know, lots of sounds came over the wall. There was a village nearby. And, you know, loudspeakers and Burmese opera, chanting. Lots of sounds came over the wall. And every day about the same time in the afternoon, there was a squealing sound that came up. And my mind perceived this squealing as pig, as a pig squealing. This was the perception. You know, the pig was the perception. I probably saw an image of a pig in my mind, or my mind said the word pig. So in any case, the squealing sound would come, and my mind would recognize it as pig. And this is the way that associative mechanism works, right? It's like sound. What's the nearest thing I've ever heard to that? Well, pig. Okay, so the mind perceived it as pig. And then the mind started to do more with that. It started to think that this squealing sound was distressed. So, you know, I could see this was a construction, this idea that this pig was distressed. But still, you know, that's what the mind recognized. So this is additional stuff. And then my mind created a story. It like went into full-on proliferation mode. And it created the story that the squealing pigs every day at the same time was because there was a butcher shop on the other side of that wall, and pigs were being slaughtered each day. So this entered into my mind. I knew this was an idea. I had seen that this was a construct. And yet, still there was a feeling of, you know, compassion for the pigs that were being slaughtered in my mind. And so there was that whole experience. This was going on over weeks, you know, this happened every day for weeks. And just watching this. And then one evening at that time, for some reason, I decided to do walking meditation instead of sitting in my room. And as I was doing the walking meditation, I noticed that there were these bats flying through the air. And they were squealing. I realized that what I had thought was pigs squealing was actually bats. So the perception in the first place had made a mistake. The whole story of it being a butcher shop vanished. The compassion vanished. There was no reason for any of that to be there. This kind of thing where there's a perception and associations that come along and filter in. This example is pretty harmless in a way. But this kind of thing happens to us all the time. So when we see how suffering works in our mind. You know, this mechanism of concept, of perception creating concept, and the associations related to concept is a big place. It's a big avenue for suffering to enter into our minds if we don't see the process of perception and conceptualization for what it is, or at least hold our perceptions and concepts lightly. This is not easy to do. So much suffering has been perpetuated in the name of concept. The concept of race, for example. pretty well established at this point scientifically that race is a human construction, not a biological reality. And so there's this concept of race and many associations, many beliefs, ideas, opinions about race come in at a very deep level. And it's all based on concept, not on any inherent reality. So much suffering in this world related to this construct, this mental construct of race. This is a large, a big manifestation of this. There's so many smaller ways that this happens too. You know, the idea of the person dismissing us because the eyebrows were raised. So many ways in which this enters into our experience. And so I'm mostly wanting you to be curious about this because, you know, this isn't something, you know, this is more information in a way. We can see some of this happening in our minds. You know, we can recognize in meditation the processes at work as I described around the pig and the bat story. We can begin to see, I mean, I knew that this was a concept. It didn't stop me from believing it. That's a piece I probably didn't really recognize, that I was believing it. I knew it was a concept, but I didn't recognize that I believed it. That might have been a little bit of additional, oh, there's a concept and I'm believing it. Okay, just know that. There's a concept and believing is happening. Sometimes we can see this in our meditation. We can at least start to recognize that our perceptions are created by the mind a little bit, you know, in our sittings, you know, noticing our mind labeling things and recognizing, you know, that this is an area sometimes that people say, I can't stop my mind from labeling things. Well, you can't stop your mind from doing its work of perception. It's doing that very naturally. And so just get familiar. This is a process of the mind. If we can begin to recognize these as processes of the mind, begin to recognize how we solidify around concepts and then also leap out into stories and ideas and beliefs around concept, we can at least maybe recognize, oh, this is a belief that's happening, rather than taking something to be truth. Oh, believing is happening. When we acknowledge believing, there's a bigger space for us to acknowledge somebody else's perspective or views, that we wouldn't come to blows or argue around the different perceptions of an elephant, but we'd say, hey, let's look into this. You perceive this, I perceive that. Let's see if we can understand what's happening there, rather than fighting about it, rather than quarreling about it. Let's look at the different directions that we're seeing experience through. So this area of perceptions and concepts not only creates a lot of a struggle in our own personal experience, but also is a huge place where our personal experience interfaces with the world and views in the large are born, and conflict in the world is born. So it's well worth understanding this process. It's well worth beginning to see it in our own minds. So mostly this is information. Perhaps it might support you if you find yourself in contention with someone about what's happened. Maybe there's some extra stuff here. Maybe, you know, so this is, in a way, we can bring in the information that we've heard to perhaps step us back from a reactivity, an automatic movement towards it. I'm right, you're wrong. To let's see what's here. Let's see if there's anything else in here. there's a lot more in here, but I think I'll stop. Comments, questions, thoughts? Yeah, would you pass the mic back? And you probably need to turn it on the side.
How do you know that the next thing you think isn't another construct that you're very attached to?
Probably it is. It can be useful to hold that perspective. And you know, that we're not trying to stop thinking. We're not trying to stop this process, but more just hold our concepts lightly and begin to be curious. You know, often we don't know that we're attached to concepts because they're not challenged. You know, and it's when they start to get challenged that we can notice this happening more often. And so, you know, when there is something that's challenged, that's a great time. Oh, curiosity. Can I be curious about this? What concept is being challenged right now? So being curious about it. And, you know, I think I'm probably attached in some form. It's not like an attachment of, oh, I want this, but I'm attached to knowing that these things are chairs. You know, it's like, it's useful. It's useful. I'm going to drop this in. I don't know that this is true. There are stories about this, and people I greatly respect believe these stories, and have met this person that I'm about ready to describe. You can read about this person, Deepama. There's a book called Knee Deep in Grace. It's a story about her experience. She's been the teacher of many of our most esteemed teachers, of Joseph Goldstein, of Sharon Salzberg, of Jack Kornfield. And she had a great power, capacity for concentration. And it is said that she had such a capacity for concentration that she could walk through walls, that she could walk in the air. One of her teachers, that she could duplicate herself and be in two places at once. And one of her teachers said that when Deepama had to show up for an interview, she would appear through the wall. She would come in through the wall. Another study was done around, she said she could duplicate herself and be in two places at once, and so they had one graduate student watching her meditate in one place, and simultaneously it is said that somebody down the street was having a conversation with her, another person who was, so, I don't know. But, you know, I do think that possibly there's something to do with my attachment to the concept that these chairs are solid. Might have something to do with the reason I can't walk through them. I don't know. So, in any case, you know, that's just a kind of a funny, no, a possibility. I don't know anybody who can do that. I did not meet Deepama. I did not witness this. And yet, you know, I know people I've respected believe this. And so it's hard to just simply dismiss. So, you know, there's probably ways that we're attached to our concepts at very deep levels. And so just assuming there's attachment there can be useful. Not that we have to, like, second-guess ourselves all the time, but in particular when there's suffering coming up, that's a useful time to recognize. Because when there's suffering coming up, there's some concept that is being held to. Suffering is about concepts. It's not about reality. And so when when there's suffering happening, it can be really useful to check into this attachment to concepts. So.
Actually, that was quite clear. What comes to mind are the two subjects everybody says you shouldn't talk about, religion and politics. And the belief system is so strongly held that there really, it does make seem to make more sense to avoid challenge. If one is so strongly connected to the belief and the other, or the others, then does that mean no discussion?
You know, I think it depends on the situation. I certainly hope there are people in this country who can have the courage to talk to each other about our deeply divided views in this country. Because if we just have to say, oh, we can't talk about this, it's kind of hopeless. And so I hope there are people who can have the courage to have that conversation. There may be times where it's not useful for an individual to go there. And I think, you know, there has to be some, you know, this is a great example, particularly politics, you know, it's especially these days. It's a great exploration of, you know, the perspective that we hold. Actually, I just heard somebody say, you know, that it, kind of in, along the lines of this elephant analogy, I was listening to, I think it was in This American Life podcast or something, about, you know, the views of people, and that tolerance is typically what's preached. Let's have tolerance of other people's views. And this person was suggesting, let's go beyond tolerance. Let's actually have the conversation. Tolerance creates these separate pools, in effect. You know, we can kind of sit back and tolerate the other person, but not actually get into conversation and see, you know, what's going on. And suggested that people from different political parties might be able to recognize, you know, what he said, what this person said was, it's interesting how everybody believes that their own perspective is motivated by love and compassion, and the other people's perspective is motivated by hate. And so everybody believes that. And so maybe we can start to try to find that alignment around compassion and love and see, you know, can we step back from that and find out, okay, we've got different perspectives on how to get there. Let's talk about that. So, you know, there are times when it can be not useful in particular one-on-one situations. But I do think, you know, we need to have the conversation about the elephant. And that's probably time to stop. Thank you for your attention.